All right, you have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Two minutes for
rebuttal,
please.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the Court. I represent Mr. Parsons. We've raised one issue on appeal, whether or not Mr. Parsons should have been found guilty of a felony as opposed to misdemeanor DUI. And the only issue is whether one of the prior convictions counts as a predicate offense. I want to correct something that I put in my brief, and I just noticed this last night. On page 6, I put on there that that the summons showed that Mr. Parsons was found guilty or convicted under that code section. That should have been charged, not convicted. I want to make that correction. And I want to make another correction. This actually goes to the Commonwealth's brief. The Commonwealth submits that there's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Parsons was convicted under the summons. I submit to you that another piece of evidence we introduced, which is the printout from the Virginia Courts criminal, I think it's called Courts Case Information website. And that evidence, I submit to you, sometimes, I guess most of the time, that evidence would probably be objected to, should not come in. But as we established earlier, evidence comes in, it comes in. So.
Well, right, but it says what the charge, the initial
yes.
charge was, and it yes. says what the final disposition was,
yes.
but that document doesn't tell you anything that may have happened in between. Normally, for a criminal defendant, that would work to the benefit because there's a higher charge and then somewhere along the line, the guilty is a lower charge.
That's
but
correct.
There is no evidence as to what the final disposition was based on that, what the crime was on that website, it seems to me.
Well Your Honor, what you alluded to, I think... it does show tell us what let me say this. If we're going to go outside the record, I would say that when you look at the Virginia Courts Case Information website, it will tell you the charge that the person is eventually convicted of. If it's a misdemeanor, it will list that on there, and then I have the sentence. Now, here all we have is 18.2-266.1. Again, I'm referring to Defendant's Exhibit Number 2 that was introduced in evidence.
But isn't the dispositive document page 94 of the appendix that says he was convicted of 18.2-266 with no qualification?
Normally, that would be dispositive, but as I think it was the Mwangi case, M-W-A-N-G-I, states, the Commonwealth has a burden to prove a prior conviction, and once you get that in, then it can be rebutted. And we submit to you it was rebutted. We don't, let's be clear, we don't have to prove that Mr. Parsons was actually found guilty of 18.2-266.1.
No, you have to prove he wasn't convicted of 18.2-266,
yes.
Or you have to rebut the
yes, exactly, and that's my point. We don't have to prove the affirmative, we just have to prove that he was not.
Defendant doesn't have a burden of proof.
Yes,
we
yes.
get that.
So there's
a rebuttable.
Yes.
Inference.
So all we're saying is that we raised enough of a doubt regarding his conviction to cast doubt on whether or not that conviction should actually stand.
Well, isn't the appropriate remedy, if you believe the conviction order is in error, to file a motion pursuant to 801-428-B, asking the, I guess in this case, the Essex County General District Court to correct its record? And the fact that you didn't do that,
yes.
couldn't the trial court take that into consideration, that the certified copy of the conviction that it had received that says he was in fact convicted of DUI is accurate?
Yeah, no, I don't know if, I don't think that proves anything. I don't think just because we did not take that action on lower court, I don't think that means, I don't know if the court means like there's a conscience of guilt on the defendant's part.
But I mean, if you're going to facially attack a prior conviction and say, essentially it has a typo in it, wouldn't in the better way to do that rather than, because there's some pretty strong case law that says that if this is a collateral attack on that conviction, you can't do it. Vester makes that clear. The only time you can collaterally attack a prior conviction in a recidivism scheme is if the person did not have counsel at the prior conviction, and from the face of the document, he did.
Yes.
And you raised no dispute to that.
No.
So, given that you can't collaterally attack the conviction, and I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but an argument could be made that you are, The code provides another way, if this is truly a clerical error, that your client didn't avail himself of. And I guess my question is, why not?
Well, I guess the first response is, be careful what you ask for. That's the first thing. But the second response is this, John. We don't know what happened. We're not here to present an explanation for what happened.
Your client knows what happened. Well, he was there.
But we have to go about what the evidence is in the record.
And the evidence in the record says he was there and was found guilty of 18.266.
Well, Your Honor, yes. It also says that my client was charged with a show cause violation a couple years later, and that's, if you look at the show cause violation, which is Defense Exhibit Number 3, the very last page of the appendix, that show cause violation lists underlying charge, and it doesn't have the code section, but it makes it very clear as to what was colloquially called the baby DUI statute, because it talks about operating a vehicle with BAC of 0.02, which is the 18.266. So that evidence cannot be ignored, and that obviously, as I point out, we have the printout from the Virginia Courts Information website. That's very important.
Can the trial court as fact finder go, but I find the conviction order, it was prepared and signed by a judge. It's not a show cause order that was probably prepared by a clerk. It's not a data entry made by a clerk on a system. It's a certified order from the clerk's office signed by a judge that's what in fact happened.
The trial judge certainly said that in this case, but I submit to you the trial judge in the Mwangi case said this is sufficient. And another case I will cite, this was cited in both of our briefs, the Palmer case, not for the specific proposition, but it was cited in both our brief and the Commonwealth's brief. That's Palmer versus Commonwealth. In that case, the prior conviction was from juvenile court. The trial judge had signed it, and the issue was whether or not it showed a felony or a misdemeanor. And the trial judge in that case, this is sufficient, I'm going to reject that. But then as it turns out...
But it, because it didn't identify the code section.
Well,
so we didn't know whether it was a felony or whether if he had been tried as an adult, it was a felony or a misdemeanor. This order has the code section.
Well, Your Honor, in the Palmer case, maybe the code section wasn't charged, but was indicated, but the charge itself was indicated, which is burglary, which is a felony case.
Well, right, but this isn't just a charge. This is a conviction.
Well, Your Honor, certainly I'm not arguing that those cases are directly applicable to this case, but here's what I'm saying. The general principle is the Commonwealth has a burden to prove prior conviction. That presumption can be rebutted by the defense. That's what we did in this case.
Well, and you provided a series of things to rebut the presumption,
yes.
None of which were certified orders of a court. You had the show. You had the summons, show cause. You had the website thing. You had the list of the charges from the general district court, and you had the amended first offense DUI, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. But again, I will reiterate that once the evidence is in, it's in. That
right.
It was admitted to evidence. There was no objection from the Commonwealth.
Right. I'm not.
Doesn't that go to weight that none of them is an actual official document signed by a judge?
Well. This isn't a situation where, let me say this. These are, the evidence that we introduce is not evidence from the defendant or from someone who was in court. Oh, no, that's not what happened. These are, in effect, official documents. We have the show cause.
They are official documents, absolutely.
Yes.
But they're not court orders signed by a judge and entered into the record of the court.
They are not, but they're official documents.
They're a variety of
show cause summons. The summons, the original summons, okay. And the printout from the court's website. And I would just point this out. The Palmer case and the Mwangi case, and I don't read them to say, these are the only ways that you can undermine the predicate conviction. I don't think they limit it just to those two ways that were attacked and successfully attacked in Palmer and Mwangi. I submit to you that there are other ways that can be attacked. In this case, you know, if this was just a printout from a court's website, well, maybe that's not sufficient. Maybe if it was just a summons and that's it. But here we have a summons and subsequent show cause. I think it's a summons or capias and a printout from the court's website. That's a lot of evidence to rebut that presumption.
Well, okay, so you come up with an argument that the Commonwealth has responded, there's a reasonable explanation that may not be, we can't say for certain it's what happened, but comes up with a reasonable explanation for what happened. And that's simply this. He was originally arrested by an officer who had a summons book, who issues the summons because he doesn't have a BAC back, but he does have a person under the age of 21 who's driving a car, clearly intoxicated. The BAC comes back, and the officer goes, oh my goodness, he's not in violation of 18.2, 266.1, what I charged him with, because he's over .08, because once you get over .08, you're no longer in violation of that code section, and so goes to a magistrate and swears out a warrant. That certainly seems to be a logical series of events that's supported by the documentary evidence, does it not?
Yeah, no, I respectfully disagree. That's a very nice presentation of what could have happened. But that is just a lot of speculation. I understand those of us who...
But we're at a point where all inferences go to the Commonwealth. And so even if I can speculate about that, isn't that what's unreasonable about that inference?
Yeah, that is a lot of speculation. I think I certainly submit that perhaps there are cases that occurred, but there's absolutely no evidence that's what happened in this case. And by the way, the verdict...
Other than a conviction order.
Well, I'm talking about the narrative that the court just presented.
So let's go back to your record. Let's go back to what is in the record.
Yes.
What is the standard for once the Commonwealth has established the element, which is the order that's entered, that's certified, and the defendant goes to rebut it, and the defendant puts on all this evidence rebutting it, what is the standard for the appellate court at this point in terms of reviewing all of that?
Well, it has to be plainly wrong without evidence to support.
Okay.
But that's the same standard that was applicable in the Mwangi case. That was the same standard that was applicable in the Palmer case. And I submit to you that, here's an important point. In the Palmer case, the Court of Appeals actually affirmed the conviction. It wasn't until it went to the Supreme Court. And when you read the facts of the Palmer case, if you didn't know the results, you just read it, you said, oh, they're definitely going to affirm. And obviously they're reversed. So I understand when you say plenty wrong, what evidence to support it, without any evidence means no evidence. But there were obviously evidence in the Mwangi case, there was obviously evidence in the Palmer case, to support the trial judge's ruling. But nonetheless, those cases were reversed.
In Palmer, they said that the key piece of evidence, the only piece of evidence that matters, is the actual conviction order. And if it doesn't specify whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, then it tells you nothing at all. The key piece of evidence here is if we extend that logic, the key piece of evidence here is the conviction order at page 94. And it specifies what the conviction is for with complete clarity. Does it not?
Complete clarity if that's all you have. But the court was introduced evidence, and the evidence wasn't testimony of a witness. The evidence was official documents from the Commonwealth website, official documents from the judicial records of the Commonwealth. And I submit to you that when you look at all the evidence together, there was reasonable doubt in this case. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
We'll give you a little extra because Judge Russell had lots of questions, so we'll give you... All right, Mr. Obenshane, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Chris Obenshane representing the Commonwealth in this matter. The question that we have before us is really whether he successfully rebutted the Commonwealth's evidence that there was, in fact, a conviction for DUI. Parsons conceded the fact of the conviction in 2008, and he conceded on his brief that there was prima facie evidence of the conviction in 2005. There's been a lot of talk about the Palmer and Mwangi cases, and so I'll start with the quote from Palmer v. Commonwealth, which tells us that a court's orders are presumed to accurately reflect what actually transpired and nothing more. And that the court said that in Palmer, and so here what we have is a court's order telling us what actually transpired. He was charged with a DUI under 18.2-266. He was present. He was represented by counsel. He pled guilty. He was found guilty as charged on the back of the warrant. And the order was signed by a judge evidencing a rendition of judgment in that case. And so the court's order there is presumed to reflect what actually transpired in the Essex County General District Court.
Mr. Obenchain, investor dealing with enhanced sentences for DUI, we specifically held that the only permissible collateral attack on a prior conviction is for the actual absence of counsel. Is this argument in this case an impermissible collateral attack, or is it something slightly different?
Well, Your Honor, what I understand his argument to be is simply that the evidence was insufficient for the trial court to find that that the Commonwealth had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he had two prior convictions.
So this would not be an impermissible collateral attack. It's just a straight sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Your Honor, that's the way that I understand his argument, is straight sufficiency of the evidence. And certainly, given that fact, we look at what the evidence was, and all the logical inferences are given to the Commonwealth here. What he raises, the difference between this case and the two other cases that he relies upon in Mwangi and Palmer, in Mwangi, the evidence that the Commonwealth presented contradicted itself. There was an order that wasn't signed, and so that order didn't evidence a rendition of judgment in the General District Court. We don't have that here. It's a different. Here, there's no error on the face of the order that would indicate that something else happened other than a conviction for a DUI. And in Palmer, there were records from the juvenile and domestic court, but I believe the court indicated that the records didn't show that he was convicted of any particular delinquent act. It was insufficient to show exactly what he was convicted of. And again, here, that's not what we have. We have a record that is clear on its face, that the charge was a DUI, and that he was convicted as charged. He was found guilty as charged. The principle articulated in McMillan v. Commonwealth is that a court may not engage in conjecture or surmise in determining the offense for which a defendant was convicted. And typically that's been applied to the Commonwealth in some of these cases. But I would argue that principle applies equally to the Commonwealth and to the defendant, that the court can't engage in conjecture in trying to determine that he was convicted of another offense where the record clearly shows that he was convicted of this offense.
In a criminal case, why would mutuality like that be required? Because it seems to me that I can engage in conjecture and surmise that keeps me from getting to beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's your burden, not his.
That is the Commonwealth's burden, Your Honor. But I think what I'm arguing is that where the evidence shows that he was convicted of a particular offense, in this instance, he hasn't produced evidence that there was another conviction, that there was a conviction of other offense.
Well, he certainly has produced a bunch of government records that would at least call into question whether it was really baby DUI or DUI, right? He's put out there a bunch to rebut what the Commonwealth has, which is the order. He put out a bunch of documents that are, they're not court orders signed by a judge, but there's several official documents that indicate that it was under the point one.
And I would argue, Your Honor, that all of those pieces of evidence, there's two things about it. First of all of those pieces of evidence say the same thing, which is that he was charged with 18.2 266.1. None of them say he was convicted of that. And then secondly...
Well, wait a minute. It may not be sufficient to disprove the conviction for 18.2-266, but the show cause says the offense for which he is being... that led to the BASAP program for which he is being show caused for failing to complete does seem to suggest... I mean, he had to have been convicted of an offense to go into the BASAP program to be subject to the show cause, and the show cause does list 0.02, which really doesn't describe an offense at all unless it describes 18.2-266.1. He had to be if that's the predicate of, if that's the offense giving rise to the show cause, don't you concede that that's a, he had to have been convicted of it? I mean, how could you be show caused if you weren't convicted?
Well, the document indicates that was the underlying charge, that there was an underlying charge on that offense. But again, it doesn't...
Right, but the underlying charge in a show cause... I mean, can you have an underlying charge, something other than an underlying conviction in a show cause proceeding? Because unless you've been convicted of the underlying offense, there is no show cause, by definition, right?
That would be true. I mean, you obviously have to be convicted of something to be show caused on that thing. I would say that's true. But again, I think that gets to my second point, which is the difference between an order, which has a presumption, a court's order, which has a presumption of reliability, versus these other unauthenticated documents that were presented to the court, which don't carry that presumption. And so the court was in a position to apply a different weight to those documents that were presented and were unauthenticated versus the order that was presented and authenticated in addition to the DMV transcript, which was also presented and which also showed that he was had two convictions for the very same offense. It was listed exactly the same on the DMV transcript.
Could, at this point in time, the executive issue an order of clemency in the form of commutation if there is sufficient evidence for the executive to determine that he should have been convicted of 18.2-661?
I would have to confess to the court that I don't know at this point whether...
What I'm saying is we have, as I've understood this record, clear record of what has happened. Maybe it shouldn't have happened. Maybe there was a clerical error. Maybe something happened along the way. But nevertheless, the conviction second was 18.266. What I'm hearing is there's a lot of argument that it ought to have been. And boy, I have many times that I remember my mother and father telling me that. But the executive has clemency power. And if there is an offense, can pardon, can do a lot of things. And my argument is that we're bound by what's there. But there are alternatives to get that correct. You don't have to answer. That's my speech.
Okay. Well, I think...
Evidently, I'm contagious.
And I think perhaps that goes to another question that was raised in the brief, the reliance on the case of Guba v. Commonwealth, where he indicates that where the record establishes a contrary intent, this court should rely on the intent and not on just the words of the order. And I think here, the reliance on that case is misplaced here because there was no record of, or there was no evidence of what the record in the original DUI conviction. There was wasn't a transcript, there wasn't any notation on the order itself indicating that the trial court's intent was anything other than to convict him of 18.2-266. And to that point, I would also note that his sentence was only consistent with 18.2-266 and not with 18.2-266.1 as it existed at the time of the conviction in 2005. So I think that's another piece of evidence the court can look at to indicate that the sentence he received was inconsistent with a conviction for 266.1.
Could you get BASAP for baby DUI in 2005?
As I recall,
I can look it up later if you don't know.
My reading of the statute as it existed at that time was that the punishment was a forfeiture of the license to suspend for 6 months and a fine of not more than $500.
So the fine was consistent, but it's the other things that
the fine was consistent, the license suspension was inconsistent, and I would argue that the jail sentence was inconsistent because it wasn't at the time classified as a misdemeanor, or there wasn't any jail time associated with that offense as it existed in 2005.
And if I understood your recitation of the 2005 18.2 266.1, did not allow for a restricted license either. It was forfeiture of the license.
Actually, in looking at the statute, it would allow for VASAP and for a restricted license.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think all of that evidence, based upon all of that evidence, the trial court's finding in this case was not plainly wrong or without evidence to support it, and we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you're going to have, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Which is pretty generous.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'm going to address this conjecture issue that was brought up. The Commonwealth's position is that, and I think Judge Russell kind of pointed to this, that Mr. Parsons was given a summons and then he was charged with DUI. And I submit to you there's no evidence to support that. Now, the Commonwealth talks about later in the day the magistrate issued a warrant, and I am not sure where that evidence comes from, because if you look at the warrant has the date that the warrant was issued. I'm sorry, the time that was issued. The summons just has the time of the offense. It doesn't say what time the summons was actually issued. Well, so there's no way we're going to know.
But short of him having previously been charged with DUI earlier in the day, which would defeat your argument entirely, I mean, in the regular process, the officer would have the summons. Somebody had to go to before a magistrate to get the warrant. The warrant, there's no question that on that day a warrant was gotten for the offense of DUI. You don't dispute that, correct?
Well, I think the prima facie evidence is that the warrant was issued for Mr. Parsons. Yes, Your Honor. But other than that, we don't know what happened. We don't know the sequence of events. And I don't think we can infer from the evidence. I know we look at light most favorable to common, but I don't think we can infer from the evidence that's what happened in this case.
Could he have committed two offenses that day and been charged once by summons, once by warrant?
A lot of things are possible. And let me just point something else out. On the summons, it has a court date of April 21st. If you look at the summons, which is on page 100 of the appendix. If you look at that printout that we presented evidence, again, came in with no objection, printout from the Commonwealth's website. That printout showing Mr. Parsons, I would argue, convicted of 18.2-266.1. That printout shows his first court day was April 21st, which is consistent with the date on the summons. So I'm presenting this argument to rebut this explanation that was given by the Commonwealth and the narrative that they were given and their facts that this is what happened. We don't know what happened. And again, the burden is not on us. It's not on us to prove this is what happened. All we're saying is we raise a reasonable doubt.
But at this stage, why are those inferences not reasonable?
Well, because in light of Mwangi and the light of Palmer, that's why. Because those two cases established the proposition that no matter what kind of record you have, you can always rebut it. And sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not. And obviously, those two cases are not the only things that can rebut it. If I can just say one more thing before my time is up. I will concede that on the face of the Commonwealth's argument that the 12-month license suspension is actually a pretty good argument. That's the first time that this was raised. It was raised by the Commonwealth and the Attorney General.
Good for them that they're the appellee. Yeah.
And that's the first argument. That's the first time the argument was raised. And on the face of it, it's a very good argument. But I would submit to you, if you analyze a little bit further, it really is not as strong as it looks. Because, first of all, just because you have a sentence doesn't mean that that's what you're convicted of. And I would, for that proposition, I'll look at the Mwangi case. On the back of the warrant, the person was sentenced. He had a sentence, and the Commonwealth made a very reasonable argument. Well, of course he was convicted. Look at, he got a sentence. Similarly, in this case, just because he got 12 months license suspended doesn't mean that it was not 18.2, that's 266.1. Judges of this Commonwealth, with all the respect to all the judges in this Commonwealth, they impose illegal sentences once in a while. And we recently had a case on the Court of Appeals not too long ago that was reversed because the sentence was over the maximum. So that doesn't prove anything.
I am familiar with that case. But then I guess you'd also concede that district court clerks fill out show cause forms wrong all the time, too.
That's a very good point, yes, John. I would certainly concede that, yes, John.
Anything else?
Thank you.